but not everyone seemed to care as much as Berryman, that foul play could have played a role in determining where the World Cup would be held. For most of the people on the case, it all seemed rather straightforward. Run it like any other investigation, and when the well went dry, pack up and move on. But Berryman didn't see it that way at all. He had no intention of stopping until he had brought down every corrupt FIFA boss, all of the men who sat in that underground bunker in Zurich and stole from the game. When he wasn't filing subpoenas or combing through the results of them, he spent every spare moment reading up on soccer corruption. He forwarded the articles, one after the next, to the rest of the team, excited for them to learn the latest developments on the subject. But all too often, the articles he enthusiastically passed along to the rest of the team sat in their inboxes, unopened and unread. Norris and Hector had gone into the Blazer proffers, hoping to confirm suspicions that FIFA elections were rigged, and that high officials routinely accepted bribes in exchange for their votes. They were not disappointed. Blazer's tale was complicated but fascinating, and often downright funny, peppered with off-color anecdotes and dirty jokes. The man's charisma, difficult to spot in the photos of him dressed in silly Halloween costumes on the internet, was obvious to everyone in the room. He had a certain magnetic presence, and it was becoming easier to see how a soccer outsider from a country with little interest in the sport could have risen so far. Right off the bat, Blazer confessed he had agreed to take money in exchange for his vote for South Africa to host the 2010 World Cup, and that other countries had tried to bribe him at the same time as well. He had also, he said, helped coordinate a bribe for Warner to vote for Morocco to host the 1998 World Cup, although he personally received no money because he wasn't a member of FIFA's Exco at the time. This kind of activity wasn't rare, Blazer said. It was the rule, and everybody on the FIFA Exco knew it was happening. But if the prosecutors wanted to know where the real filth was in soccer, the truly big money and pervasive corruption, then they needed to look beyond the periodic big votes in Zurich, beyond the selection of World Cup sites or FIFA presidents, and all the other events that garnered the headlines. The financial heart of the sport, Blazer explained, was in the marketplace for commercial rights, the contracts that allowed broadcasters to put soccer matches on the air and advertisers to plaster their logos on uniforms, stadiums, and halftime shows. It was those deals, thousands of them around the world, that made up nearly all of FIFA's billions of dollars in revenue. And it was hardly just FIFA. Each of the six regional confederations had its own set of rights to sell, and in turn each of the more than 200 national associations around the world had a variety of rights to offer as well. There were massive tournaments such as the ultra-popular annual Champions League of Europe's top professional clubs, run by UEFA, the European Confederation, or CONMEBOL's Copa America, held every 4 years and showcasing superstars like Argentina's Lionel Messi. There were hotly contested World Cup qualifying matches in each region, and there were sponsorship opportunities for every national team. Nobody wore a Nike or Adidas uniform for free, after all. The counterparty to nearly every one of those rights deals, Blazer explained, was a sports marketing company, the middlemen of the international sports world. It was a vast and robust, though little known, industry, dedicated to scooping up sponsorship and television rights to sporting events wholesale, then turning around and reselling them a la carte to networks, brands, and advertisers. Operating on the principle that organizations such as FIFA, the Oceania Football Confederation, or the Federación Panameña de Fútbol don't have the staff or expertise to sell their rights directly. Sports marketing companies offered a fixed price ahead of time to take the rights off the soccer officials' hands. As with any business, profits depended on paying as little as possible for the goods they turned around and resold. And the best way to ensure that the cost for soccer rights stayed below market value was to shut out the competition. That, Blazer emphasized, was where the corruption came in. Sports marketing companies systematically bribed soccer officials to keep prices low and not sell their rights to anyone else. The bribes came each time a contract was negotiated, or extended, and occasionally even in advance of a negotiation, just to ensure things ran as expected. Sometimes officials demanded the payments. Other times the sports marketing firms offered them. Either way, the understanding was the same. We pay you under the table, and in return you give us an exclusive sweetheart deal for the rights. While the sporting press agonized over each political development that emerged from FIFA's Zurich headquarters, hundreds if not thousands of soccer officials around the world were getting bribes and kickbacks for television and marketing rights, with little if any scrutiny. Without doubt, there were legitimate rights deals out there, and soccer officials that were either too clean or too closely watched to take bribes. But it was a safe bet that the vast majority of soccer marketing deals, from the most prominent international tournaments to meaningless regional friendlies, involved no-bid contracts that undercut the actual value of the rights. That, by definition, deprived the sport of money that could be spent on development, literally giving balls and cleats to impoverished children. While the officials running soccer secretly pocketed huge sums, and sports marketing executives got filthy rich in the process. The sums of money were huge. FIFA, for example, booked $2.4 billion in television rights sales from the 2010 World Cup, and an additional $1.1 billion in sponsorship and other advertising rights. There was also more money in the U.S. than might be apparent. Thanks to the country's roughly 50 million Hispanics, it was in fact one of the most valuable markets in the world. In 2005, for example, Blazer had helped negotiate a deal for the U.S. television rights to the 2010 and 2014 World Cups, a package that also included two Women's World Cups and two Confederations Cups, a smaller tournament played in World Cup host countries 1 year before the big event. ABC and ESPN had paid a respectable $100 million for the English language rights to that package. But Univision, which perennially ranked far behind the traditional broadcast heavyweights, paid more than three times that, a whopping $325 million, to transmit the same slate of matches to the country's Spanish-speaking audience. By comparison, TV Globo of Brazil paid $340 million for the same rights in the most soccer-crazy nation on earth. The fast-growing value of the sport helped to underscore the scale of the corruption. Since 2003, CONCACAF had sold rights to the Gold Cup directly to networks and sponsors, using its own dedicated in-house sales team in order to cut out the middleman. As a result, in 2011, CONCACAF took in $31.1 million in television revenue alone, the vast majority from the Gold Cup. By contrast, the Copa America, a far more popular and competitive tournament starring some of the biggest stars in global soccer, brought in surprisingly little to CONMEBOL. The deal the South American Confederation had years earlier signed with Traffic for the tournament paid a measly $18 million for the complete package of television and sponsorship rights to the 2011 edition. Clearly, the Copa America should have been worth vastly more than the Gold Cup. But by agreeing to sell the tournament for far below market value in exchange for bribes from Jose Avila, the men who controlled CONMEBOL, had vastly limited the amount the Confederation could bring in for its most valuable asset. It was hardly a coincidence, Blazer continued, that Traffic had for years paid bribes to him and Warner for rights to the Gold Cup as well, and that Avila had years earlier opened one office in Miami just to handle CONCACAF-related rights. Soccer, Blazer made clear, was populated by two kinds of people, those who took bribes and those who paid them. If the Justice Department really wanted to clean up the sport, it needed to take a hard look at men like Avila, who sat perched like fat spiders at the very center of the vast web of corruption. Nobody in the room had ever heard of Traffic or Avila. Even Berryman, despite all his late-night reading on the soccer business, drew a blank when Blazer mentioned his name. It took a long time for Blazer to explain the complicated world of sports marketing and the equally complex structure of FIFA and its many satellite entities. As Blazer spoke, An idea slowly started to form in Norris's head, and he felt a growing current of excitement. Midway through the third proffer, on January 18, 2012, he called a break and walked out into the hallway outside the conference room to huddle with the rest of the team. Norris seemed unusually animated, and his eyes lit up as he made a triangle shape with his hands, joining his fingers together in front of his face. International Soccer, FIFA, CONCACAF, CONMEBOL, and the Trinidad and Tobago Football Association were all part of a single whole. They clearly fit the definition of a top-down enterprise, the classic organized crime triangle chart. There was a boss, Sepp Blatter. There were underbosses, the FIFA Executive Committee and the executives of the six regional confederations. And there were soldiers, the officers of each national federation. There were even consiglieri, the advisors and lawyers who helped the bosses run the show. A $10 million bribe to Warner and Blazer for their 2010 World Cup votes. An envelope stuffed with $40,000 in cash for the president of some obscure Caribbean soccer federation. A kickback for the TV rights to a handful of Central American World Cup qualifiers. These weren't unconnected events. They weren't discreet and unrelated scams. It was all connected, Norris said, eyes shining. FIFA sanctioned the confederations. The confederation sanctioned the national associations. And the sports marketing firms greased everyone's palms. Men like Blazer or Blatter or Nicolas Leos in South America or Mohammed bin Hammam atop the Asian Confederation might not have a hand in every crooked deal, but they were all part of the same cohesive enterprise. They had taken over soccer and corrupted it. And now this was how the sport operated all the time. Norris, Hector, and the FBI agents all had organized crime backgrounds. They recognized these kinds of structures, and perhaps were overly primed to see them everywhere they looked. But they had tried to go into Blazer's proffers with open minds, unsure of what they were really dealing with in a still-developing case. Now it was abundantly clear. Global soccer was a kind of organized crime. In fact, they increasingly felt, it looked just like the mafia. It was a crucial intellectual leap for the case. It meant that everything was fair game, and everyone could, at least in theory, be prosecuted together under a single statute that would allow the prosecutors to leap across oceans and back through decades of corruption to build one unified, sweeping argument. Berryman had been right. This did look like a RICO case. Chapter 14. The King is Dead. Long live the King. Enrique Sanz, a traffic vice president in Miami, spent the early months of 2012 trying to handicap who the next president of CONCACAF would be. Sanz, a serious young Colombian, had been the Brazilian sports marketing firm's man in the Caribbean for more than a decade, and had deep contacts in the region. He understood that the Caribbean's 3-1 majority in the Confederation all but guaranteed that the winning candidate would come from one of the islands. Full Play, Traffic's increasingly bitter rival, had failed to grasp that rather critical fact. And the $450,000 in bribes it had paid at the end of the previous year to try to secure rights to the Gold Cup had been in vain. The Port of Spain bribery scandal was still reverberating, and numerous Caribbean officials were either under FIFA investigation or had been suspended, making it tough to predict which Caribbean would get the job. As far as Traffic was concerned, however, it was critical that Sanz answer the burning question as soon as possible. With the Copa America lost, Traffic simply could not cede any more ground in soccer rights. The firm still controlled all of the CFU's 2014 World Cup qualifiers, and most of Central America's as well. But Media World, a rival in Miami, was steadily stripping those away. Since the greatest value when it came to reselling rights to sponsors and broadcasters was to bundle them by region, Traffic in early 2012 finally elected to join forces with MediaWorld. The two firms signed an accord to split all costs and revenue, including bribes. The question of exactly whom to bribe became much clearer toward the end of February, when Sands, conferring with contacts in the Caribbean, learned that the Confederation's next president was almost certainly going to be Jeffrey Webb. An affable 47-year-old from the Cayman Islands, Webb was not a well-known figure in world soccer. He had never played the game, but seemed to enjoy it, helping run an amateur club in Georgetown, Strikers FC, when he was still in college. In 1991, he was elected president of the Cayman Islands Football Association, known as CIFA, and eventually worked his way onto FIFA's Internal Audit Committee and its Transparency and Compliance Committee. He also had the distinct advantage, unlike many of his Caribbean colleagues, of remaining untainted by the Port of Spain scandal. Although Webb had been in Trinidad for the meeting, he had never been accused of taking money, and indeed had helped Blazer and Collins with their initial investigation in the days following the conference. Good-looking, sharply dressed, almost debonair, he seemed the antithesis of Jack Warner, approachable where the Trinidadian was threatening, compromising where Warner was rigid, clean and respectable where the longtime CFU president radiated gangsterism and self-interest. But despite his low profile, Webb had built an influential network of friends in the Caribbean, thanks in great part to his day job. Since 1990, Webb had worked at Fidelity Bank Cayman Limited, rising to become manager of business development and a director at the bank. In that role, he oversaw a variety of financial services divisions, including investment banking, corporate finance, risk management, and especially money transfer operations at the Western Union branches Fidelity operated in the Caymans. Over the years, Webb helped numerous Caribbean soccer officials set up anonymous offshore companies and bank accounts where they could receive payments without drawing unwanted attention. In 1995, for example, he incorporated one such company, J&D International, that was used by Jack Warner to receive income from sales of television rights he had been awarded, sometimes for as little as $1, in sweetheart patronage deals from FIFA. Enrique Sands knew Webb well and had chatted with him at 100 different CONCACAF events over the years. But because Warner had always exclusively negotiated rights deals for the entire CFU, keeping the bribes for himself, Sands had never had occasion to talk to Webb about how the business really worked. Now he had little choice. Working fast, Sands approached Webb even before the man had officially announced his political intentions, offering Traffic's full financial support for his campaign. Sands also delicately made it clear that, should Webb be elected, he could expect to receive side payments in exchange for awarding Traffic the rights to the CFU's qualifying matches for both the 2018 and 2022 World Cup cycles. Webb, it turned out, didn't require much explanation. In fact, the banker immediately understood what Sands was hinting at, seemed to be expecting the offer, and was clearly of the opinion that such payments were a standard perk of the job, ones he'd been looking forward to receiving. But he also made a special request. Sands should never negotiate bribes directly with Webb, but instead with a close friend, a British-born Greek Cypriot named Kostas Takis, who had briefly served as CIFA's general secretary a decade earlier. Takis controlled several holding companies in the Caymans and the British Virgin Islands, that had bank accounts at Webb's bank, Fidelity. Soon after talking with Webb, Sands wired $50,000 to one of Takis's companies, CPL Limited, calling it candidacy money. No rival candidates ever declared, and by late March, Webb had won the support not only of most of the Caribbean, but several Central American officials as well. On March 26th, Webb accepted the formal nomination to be CONCACAF's next president, resigning his position at Fidelity Bank. "I am humbled by the tremendous outpouring of support and encouragement received from so many of the member countries," Webb said. If elected, It is my intention to build on that unity through collaboration, transparency, integrity, engagement, and accountability. The Boscolo New York Palace Hotel in Budapest is not, by any measure, understated. Built at the end of the 19th century to house the local offices of New York Life Insurance Company, it blends Greek, Roman, Renaissance, Rococo, and Baroque styles into a kaleidoscope of ornamentation and curlicue that the building's current owners describe as eclectic. It was, in other words, precisely the kind of forum that proves irresistible to international soccer officials. With its abundant gold leaf, towering frescoes, and generously apportioned marble, the Boscolo was a perfect venue for a sporting coronation. Early on May 23, 2012, CONCACAF's delegates crowded into the hotel's brightly lit Roma conference room, along with Sepp Blatter, numerous other soccer officials, and a raft of consultants, attorneys, and sports marketing executives. The Confederation had organized the one-day meeting around FIFA's annual Congress, scheduled to start the following day at the Congress and World Trade Center in Budapest. But before Jeffrey Webb, impeccably turned out in a navy suit and burgundy tie, could celebrate the start of his new three-year mandate, the American lawyer John Collins addressed the room to announce the results of a preliminary audit of the Confederation's finances. They were, to put it mildly, worrisome. The review had turned up numerous irregularities, among them Blazers' 10% contracts, which had cost the Confederation tens of millions of dollars over the years.
It had also discovered that the $22.5 million Dr. Zhao Avalanche Center of Excellence,
a sports training center in Trinidad, supposedly the property of CONCACAF and largely paid for with grants from FIFA, was in fact the sole property of Jack Warner. The former president had even taken out a $1.7 million mortgage against the property for his own benefit, without the knowledge of the Confederation's executive committee. Finally, Collins noted, it appeared that Blazer had for years failed to file tax returns on behalf of CONCACAF, which as a registered United States nonprofit was bound by law to do so. As a result, the Confederation had, 2 years earlier, lost its tax-exempt status and was in serious jeopardy of owing huge sums to the Internal Revenue Service. It is difficult to predict what CONCACAF's exposure will be, Collins grimly declared. The Confederation's delegates, including those who sat on its executive committee and had blithely signed off on its financial statements for so many years, now responded with horror and outrage, decrying the obscene irregularities of these robbers with white collars. Newly elected President Webb, for his part, said he felt shock, dismay, upset at the news, adding that, "We must move the clouds and allow the sunshine in," before taking up the gavel and concluding the day's agenda. He had, indeed, many activities lined up, including a splendid private dinner in his honor at the even more elaborately decorated Carpathia restaurant in a nearby part of Budapest. That evening, over traditional Hungarian plates of goulash and strudel, Webb worked the room, which overflowed with the cream of the sporting scene as far as North America, Central America, and the Caribbean were concerned. Sunil Gulati, the president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, was there, and introduced Webb to Sameer Gandhi, an attorney from law firm Sidley Austin's New York office. Gandhi, a commercial litigator and soccer fan, who grew up playing the game on some of the same Westchester County fields Blazer once roamed, suggested that Webb retain Sidley to conduct a full investigation of CONCACAF's finances under the prior administration. Considering the unpaid taxes and unauthorized loans,
Gandhi thought the Confederation might even be facing potential criminal exposure.
Since Webb had made transparency and reform his campaign platform, the lawyer also proposed creating a working group to signal that his new administration was making a clean break from the past. Gandhi suggested calling it the Integrity Committee. This all seemed like a great idea to Webb, who eventually did hire Sidley, but for the moment the new president had more urgent priorities and soon moved on to other conversations, taking care to greet his friends from traffic, especially Enrique Sanz. Before traveling to Hungary, Sands had been in touch with Kostas Takis, working out specifics of the first rights deal Traffic hoped to strike with CONCACAF's new president. Traffic had controlled commercial rights to the World Cup qualifying matches to all the Caribbean Football Union member associations for a decade, and Jack Warner had demanded side payments on each successive deal. But with Warner gone, the rights for the 2018 and 2022 rounds of qualifiers had not yet been claimed. What would it take for Webb to cede those rights to Traffic? Sands asked. The price, Takis responded, would be $23 million for the CFU and $3 million for Webb. Take it or leave it. A $3 million bribe was a huge ask for a relatively minor rights package. Including Warner's share, the rights to the 2006 qualifiers had cost Traffic a total of just $1.7 million. But Traffic was in no position to alienate the brand new president of CONCACAF. Sands agreed, then reached out to Media World to inform its executives that its 50% share of the bribe to Webb would be $1.5 million. Now, standing amid the hubbub in the Carpathia restaurant, watching the new soccer president work the room, it was hard for a man like Sands not to detect the irony that hung almost palpably in the air. Blazer was gone. Warner was gone.
Not a thing had changed.
Sands could also perceive something else in the moment. Opportunity. On July 14th, Jeff Webb announced he had appointed Enrique Sands CONCACAF's new general secretary.
If anyone paused to wonder why a 38-year-old sports marketing executive,
with no history of political leadership in soccer, but a potentially giant conflict of interest, was a good fit for the job, there is no record of such dissent. According to a CONCACAF press release, Sands had been unanimously approved by the executive committee. "I am certain," Webb said, "that we have found a professional with competence and integrity to implement our roadmap to reform." Sands, a championship-caliber squash player from a wealthy Colombian family, said the appointment was an honor, and that he hoped to move the Confederation's headquarters to Miami, where he and all his dear friends at Traffic lived. Sands had never previously shown interest in getting personally involved in soccer governance.
He'd always been on the business side,
and though it was not unprecedented for a sports marketing executive to jump to the other side of the equation, it was exceedingly rare. Who could afford the cut in pay? Yet somehow, Sands's colleagues at Traffic seemed unsurprised by his sudden move. Aaron Davidson, the president of Traffic Sports USA, and Sands's closest friend at work, seemed downright jubilant, in fact. The firm had been in a panic for 2 years as it watched its empire slowly crumble. Now, Traffic had managed to place an inside man in the number two job at one of FIFA's most valuable confederations. They could have conducted a worldwide search and not found a better qualified guy for the job, Davidson crowed to a sports columnist from the Miami Herald. It's going to be fun to see his impact. He knows about selling TV, radio, and internet rights. He knows about getting sponsors. He is a very professional guy with new ideas, which is what CONCACAF needs. One idea that Sands had been struggling with since returning from Budapest was how exactly to pay Traffic's share of the $3 million bribe to Webb. He and Avila had spent many hours figuring out the mechanics of doing it without anyone finding out. Finally, they settled on a plan. Once Webb signed off on the rights contract, Traffic would use its account at Delta National Bank and Trust Company in Miami to wire money to a company called Time Winner Investments, with an account at an HSBC branch in Hong Kong. From there, the payment would be wired a second time to an account in the name of Cossin Ventures, a company owned by Takis, at Fidelity Bank in the Cayman Islands. From there, the money could be wired to whichever accounts Webb desired. Webb had been a banker for more than 20 years and had extensive experience with international money transfers. So, though perhaps the others could be forgiven for overlooking the fact that each of those wires would pass through easily traceable correspondent banks inside the United States of America before reaching their final destination, CONCACAF's newly elected president, who had campaigned on the promise of a new corruption-free future for soccer, could not. Chapter 15. Faster, Higher, Stronger. One evening in the spring of 2012, Chuck Blazer wheeled on his scooter into Cut, a trendy steakhouse in the Beverly Wilshire Hotel in Beverly Hills. He was meeting Alan Rothenberg, a politically connected lawyer who had, over his career, been the president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, helped create Major League Soccer, and been chief executive of the 1994 World Cup. The two men had known each other for decades. Over steaks and wine, they swapped gossip about soccer, Blazer regaling Rothenberg with stories of his exploits, some of them sexual. Blazer had called to propose the meal, but Rothenberg had thought little of it since they often got together when he was in town. Unlike prior encounters, however, this time, Blazer hadn't come alone. Sitting on the other side of the busy restaurant were Steve Berryman and Jared Randall, doing their best to look inconspicuous as they observed the conversation from a distance, a job complicated by the appearance of numerous celebrities in the restaurant. The goal of the meeting, which the agents had rehearsed with Blazer beforehand, was to talk about Morocco's failed bid for the 2010 World Cup. Rothenberg had been a consultant for the North African country's bid team, which, according to Blazer, had attempted to bribe him and Warner for their votes. But when Randall and Berryman reviewed the recording their co-operator had secretly made during the dinner, they were disappointed. Rothenberg had said nothing of particular interest. Blazer began making secret recordings soon after agreeing to cooperate. He had close relationships with an astounding number of soccer officials, and according to what he was proffering in Brooklyn, he'd conspired with many of them to commit illegal acts. The trick was to get those people to confess on tape and, thanks to the powerful FIFA Exco seat Blazer still held, there weren't too many people in the soccer world who wouldn't meet with him or pick up the phone when he called, unaware that he was recording every word. Thanks to modern technology, the days of heavy, bulky, reel-to-reel tape recorders strapped across the chest were long gone. Blazer could walk into meetings carrying devices smaller than a nickel that could be discreetly hidden in a lapel, on the strap of a bag, inside a cell phone or keychain, or even a disposable water bottle, with no worries of being discovered, or getting drenched in nervous sweat, or losing half his chest hair when it was removed. The device wasn't the problem. The problem was that most of the people of interest to the case weren't in the United States. In their weekly phone calls, Norris, Berryman, and Randall would strategize about whom Blazer should reach out to, on what pretext, and what he could say to convince them to incriminate themselves. But because they were so terrified of leaks, the prosecutor resisted sending Blazer on covert operations abroad. He'd skipped the FIFA Congress in Budapest for that very reason. His new federal taskmasters didn't trust Hungarian police, with whom they'd have to work, to keep their mouths shut. And so instead, they'd concocted a story about Blazer's health that he could use to explain his absence. But the 2012 Summer Olympics in London were coming up, and they were just too tempting to the prosecutors. Not only would the entire FIFA Exco and all its hangers-on be there, but the full galaxy of bid committee members, intermediaries, sports marketing executives, consultants, and IOC officials would be packed into town. The opportunities for interactions, where potentially incriminating recordings could be made, were tremendous. FIFA had a large contingent due at the games, and so nobody would be at all surprised to see Blazer there. Besides, the football official's time on the Exco wouldn't last forever, at which point his value for covert operations would dramatically diminish. And yet they did not trust the Metropolitan Police, not after the leaks to the Telegraph. They also couldn't operate in London without local law enforcement, so Randall and his supervisor, Mike Gaeta, got creative. Reaching out to FBI agents stationed in the U.S. Embassy in London, they came up with a clever plan. The Metropolitan Police Service, known as Scotland Yard, was gigantic. With 32,000 sworn officers, it ranked among the world's largest police forces, only slightly smaller than the New York Police Department. But tucked inside the sprawling metropolis was a little-known, much smaller law enforcement agency, the City of London Police. Officially, that force patrolled the one-square-mile area at the very center of London, and had only about 700 officers. Yet because the City of London contained Britain's financial center, the tiny police department had developed a highly regarded economic crime directorate, which included a specialized overseas anti-corruption unit. It was staffed with a small number of elite investigators who said they would be happy to aid an American investigation. Assured by Gaeta and Randall that there would be no leaks, the team could move ahead with setting up meetings for Blazer in London. Once the secret cooperator started getting replies to the first tentative emails he sent out, it was clear the investigators were going to have plenty of opportunities, as they called it, to make tape. Less than 2 weeks into the Olympics, Berryman found himself flat on his back in his London hotel room bed, trying to listen to his own heart. It felt funny, laboring and out of rhythm, as if it were skipping a beat. Berryman had never felt it this way, and he suddenly grew very frightened. "Did I make the right decision?" he asked himself. Since arriving in London, Berryman had been engaged in what felt like the most exciting work of his career. London's enthusiasm over the Olympics had reached fever levels, and the city was overrun with movie stars, tycoons, and politicians eager to be at the center of the world for a few days. Like the World Cup, the Games are an opportunity for the elite of the sports governance world to mingle with the barons and billionaires who rule over the planet's non-sporting activities. FIFA's brass, including Sepp Blatter, were all camped at the five-star Mayfair Hotel in the heart of the action. For days on end, Berryman and Randall, accompanied by a City of London policeman, had crouched in an unmarked van parked unobtrusively on the streets of central London, where FIFA's top officials were all lodged, as Blazer, wheeling around on his scooter, chatted with some of the most powerful men in sports. He had, for example, secretly recorded a handful of Russians, including Vitaly Mutko, who had been a member of the FIFA Exco since 2009, was Russia's Minister of Sport, and had been president of the Russian Football Union, and Alexei Sorokin, the dashing, smooth-talking former head of Russia's World Cup bid, who had since been named chief executive of the local organizing committee for the 2018 tournament. Digging further, Blazer crossed Mayfair to the second-story offices of Peter Hargitay, a Hungarian public relations man who had been paid roughly $1.3 million by the Australian bid in 2009 to provide targeted lobbying within the body of the FIFA Executive Committee. Hargitay, a chain smoker with long stringy hair and a pencil-thin mustache, also had offices in Zurich, and seemed either to be friends with, or have worked for, every power broker in soccer. He had for many years been a consultant to Sepp Blatter, and had also lived in Jamaica for a decade, so he intimately knew Jack Warner and many other Caribbean soccer officials well. Before joining the Australian bid, he had worked for England's World Cup effort, and had also worked as an advisor to Mohammed bin Hammam. Yet when Blazer huffed and puffed his way up the stairs to his office in early August, the only substantive topic the men discussed was the rumor that Hargitay's computers had been hacked during the World Cup bidding process. The meeting ended in just 20 minutes. Then, as he did after every such meeting, Blazer rode over to the unmarked van and handed over his recording devices, one of which was hidden inside a fob on a keychain Randall had supplied him. Inside the van, Berryman and Randall would plug the devices into a laptop to ensure the recording had been made, and would listen to a few snippets before reviewing the conversation in detail from their hotel rooms. Berryman loved being in London, his favorite city, and being there while making tapes of the criminals who had perverted the sport he loved made the experience unforgettable. But now, flat on the hotel bed, Berryman questioned his desire to come at all. In preparation for the trip, he'd visited his doctor to check out a nagging sinus infection. It was a routine thing, but when the physician listened to the special agent's heart, she made a face. Soon, Berryman was going through a battery of tests and consulting with concerned-looking cardiologists and surgeons. The left atrium of his heart was enlarged, they said, likely the result of a minor valve problem he'd had for his entire adult life, and now he'd developed a dangerous arrhythmia. He needed surgery soon, and the timing couldn't be worse. Berryman wasn't about to miss out on London. He and the others had been planning this trip for months. He couldn't tell the doctors why he was so desperate to travel, so he simply begged. They had to let him go. Berryman's cardiac surgeon told him not to worry, and said he could travel without problems. But when Berryman came back, he'd have to go under the knife, and if anything happened while abroad, he should drop everything and come home. Struggling to stabilize his straining heart, Berryman thought about the past dozen days. He'd had a dark premonition one afternoon while eating a sandwich on a park bench in central London. A fortune teller had approached, asked him a series of questions, then stared him in the face. "You are having something done to you that will change your life forever," the old man had said, before walking off without saying another word. Another time, while sitting alone in the surveillance van on St. James Street, Berryman had spotted Blazer scooting in his direction in the side-view mirror, and got the distinct impression he was being followed. Blazer, who had just finished a recording, would stop to look into a store window, and a strange man trailing behind would stop as well. Panicked, Berryman called Randall, and when Blazer approached, he waved him off. Were they being watched? Was their cover blown? The pressure Berryman put on himself as the case developed was immense and steadily growing larger. He was 49 years old and had been an IRS agent for more than a quarter century. Because he started at the agency right out of college, he was eligible for retirement at year's end, but Berryman had put that off to work this case. He could have been at home, puttering in his yard and spending time with his wife, or working on a crime novel he was writing about an IRS agent who teams up with an FBI agent to solve a series of anti-immigrant hate crimes. Instead, Berryman could think of little else but the case. Normally, he avoided surveillance operations, leaving the technical, time-consuming, and frankly boring task of overseeing consensual recording to the FBI. He preferred to sift through bank subpoenas. But now he wanted to be in on everything, flying across the country to attend nearly every proffer with Blazer, sitting in on each strategy session, planning every step in meticulous detail. Berryman had completely dismissed the idea of retirement. He took every case seriously, but this one was special, and he knew that no matter how it ended, it would be his last. And then, suddenly, he was on an airplane back to California, where on August 15, 2012, a cardiac surgeon cracked open his chest and saved Berryman's life. Blazer's final recording in London was with Jose Javila. He had emailed the executive's personal secretary prior to the Olympics to propose a meeting, and the men finally met for breakfast in the final days of the games. Since Blazer had told the prosecutors about Avila, the Brazilian had become a subject of great interest, and the hope was to catch him admitting to paying a bribe. The plan was to focus on a peculiar payment Avila had made to the former general secretary back in 2003. The story behind the payment, according to Blazer, was that he had been short on cash and called to ask Avila to loan him $600,000. It was, of course, no loan at all, and both men knew that Blazer never intended to repay a cent. Avila, using a trusted intermediary, arranged to send the money to Blazer's sportvertising account at First Caribbean International Bank in the Cayman Islands. But the large payment raised a red flag with First Caribbean's compliance department, which wrote asking for the source of these funds, along with supporting documentary evidence. Blazer, of course, had no such thing, and dashed off an email to Havila's secretary. "We will need to construct a contract regarding this and other transfers," he wrote. To justify the payment, the two men conspired to create a phony consulting services contract between Sportfertizing and Valente, a Panamanian company owned by Avila's most trusted bagman, who made the payment. The hastily prepared 4-page document was riddled with errors, saying Sportfertizing would render consulting services to client in connection with the event's sports, which aim is to assist client in the development of sponsors and publicity's business. These vaguely defined services would allegedly cost Valente
a total of $1.3 million, split into a first $600,000 installment and a second $700,000 payment due later that year. The contract was deliberately backdated to October 1, 2002, in order to convince the First Caribbean bankers the document was legitimate, so they would release the funds to Blazer. From a prosecutor's perspective, the phony agreement, along with the bank's correspondence and Blazer's emails to traffic, neatly traced the full narrative arc of a criminal act, all tied up in a beautiful silver bow. The key was to get Avila talking about it on tape. But bringing up a 9-year-old's secret payment over a meal in London was just not done. Soccer officials didn't talk about that sort of thing after the fact, especially not in public. And so Norris and the others concocted a cover story, relying on recent news out of FIFA. Michael Garcia, a former United States attorney from New York, had just weeks earlier been appointed as the new head investigator for FIFA's ethics committee. He had been charged with reviewing the incident in Port of Spain, and by extension, CONCACAF as a whole. So, it was decided, Blazer would tell Avila he was under pressure from Garcia to review old contracts from the Confederation. Of course, Garcia hadn't so much as talked to Blazer, but it seemed a believable enough pretext. Blazer, hidden recording devices on his person, trotted the fiction out when he and Avila met in London. After the usual greetings, Blazer, speaking in Spanish, asked Avila about the $600,000 payment, making sure to state for the tape that he'd gotten the money in two batches, one from a bank in Uruguay and another from a company in Panama. Did Avila recall those? Did he happen to have the documents? Blazer felt bad asking, he said, but he was being investigated by this FIFA prosecutor, Garcia, and needed to show the man the documents to get him off his back. Avila and Blazer had known each other for years, and they got along well. Even after Blazer had cut traffic out of CONCACAF's rights deals, they'd stayed in touch, and Avila had invited Blazer to the wedding of his eldest son in Brazil several years earlier. But something seemed off to the South American, and he denied ever making any payment, insisting the two men had no business together. But Blazer was insistent, and so Avila, eager to end the conversation, finally said he'd look into it when he got back to Brazil. It was Blazer's final recording at the Olympics, the only one Berryman hadn't been able to help coordinate. Avila, who had been paying bribes to soccer officials for nearly a quarter century, had avoided implicating himself. Chapter 16. My Way. When Jeffrey Webb took over CONCACAF, he doubled down with his message of reform, never missing an opportunity to condemn his predecessors, Warner and Blazer, and promise a new clean era of soccer governance. For starters, the new president made a public show of not accepting a salary, despite warnings from advisors that doing so might actually look bad, especially since Webb had quit his banking job and had no obvious means of financial support. Then, on September 14, 2012, Webb called the first meeting of the Integrity Committee, empaneling an ex-PricewaterhouseCoopers partner, the former Chief Justice of Barbados, and a retired U.S. federal judge to chair the three-person group, which was charged with ensuring accountability, transparency, and good governance in CONCACAF, and in particular, overseeing all investigations pertaining to past practices from the previous leadership. The investigations themselves would be handled by attorneys at Sidley Austin, led by a personable and detail-oriented former federal prosecutor in New York,
named Tim Traynor. His mandate was to unpack 20 years of financial misdeeds, and it was no easy task. For months, Traynor and his colleagues sat with CONCACAF employees in marathon interview sessions, drilling them with questions about the Confederation's finances, operations, and the many complicated arrangements dreamed up by Blazer and Warner. Staffers were asked to hand over documents, dig through endless spreadsheets, and return multiple times for interviews. Those who complained that the sessions felt more like interrogations were given a simple choice: cooperate or be fired. Not everyone was willing to help, of course. Sands, the new general secretary, told the Sidley lawyers that during a September visit to Warner's former offices in Trinidad, he noticed documents being shredded and Warner himself refusing requests for interviews. And when the integrity committee wrote to Blazer asking for documents, it went nowhere. "We declined to comply with your request for documents, interviews, or other information," Blazer's attorney, Stuart Friedman, wrote. The former general secretary had kept visiting the Confederation 17th floor offices for 4 months after his last day on the job, and by the time Sidley showed up to collect documents and copy hard drives, all of Blazer's records were long gone. Even without the documents, Traynor and his colleagues began to suspect that there was indeed quite a bit of criminal exposure, particularly due to Blazer's failure to file CONCACAF's federal taxes for so many years. And in exchange for their diligent work, the firm charged handsomely, billing the Confederation roughly $1 million a month. There was one area where Traynor and his colleagues didn't poke around, however. Anything that took place after December 31st, 2011, when Blazer and Warner were both gone from the Confederation. Sidley's was strictly a backward-looking mandate, and while the lawyers hailed the reform efforts initiated by Webb, as well as the additional measures intended to safeguard the integrity of the sport by Sands, they paid scant, if any, attention to what those two men were actually up to now that they controlled the purse strings of the Confederation. "Out with Frank Sinatra," Webb grandly declared to wide-eyed CONCACAF employees in New York on occasion of his first post-election visit. "In with Jay-Z." The new president immediately declared that Chuck Blazer's and Jack Warner's adjacent offices in Trump Tower needed updating, so he brought in Sands's Brazilian wife, Roberta, to redecorate. She soon had redone the entire space, ripping out sheets of heavy marble in favor of clean lines and high-design furniture, then handed in a huge six-figure bill for the job. Then just as quickly, Webb abandoned the place, claiming he preferred to work at home in Cayman, while Sands, who couldn't stand the frigid New York winters, set up shop in Miami. Webb went to a tailor on CONCACAF's dime and got new suits fitting his state position. He hired a public relations specialist to teach him how to look good on camera and, with any luck, attain higher standing within FIFA. Webb loved flash and glitter. He adored big watches and eye-catching cars that made a lot of noise, expensive hotels, private jets, and luxurious accommodations. A divorced father of two, he was, at the time of his election, already engaged to be married a second time. But that didn't stop him from going out, night after night, paying all the bills with CONCACAF's corporate card, of course. In Sands, Webb had found a perfect general secretary, willing to approve his extravagant expenses if he'd do the same in return. Webb hired his fiancée's cousin, a lawyer in Miami, to be his in-house advisor, while Sands brought in his best friend's wife to handle human resources, despite her total lack of experience in the field. The two officials traveled where they liked, hired whom they wanted to hire, and did what they wanted to do. A soccer confederation truly was a wonderful toy to have. In mid-July, Webb invited CONCACAF's executive committee at the Confederation's expense to a several-day retreat at the luxurious Ritz-Carlton on Grand Cayman, where a gala dinner was held in his own honor. Before a room of 250 people, Webb was showered with praise before being awarded the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Medal of Honor by Makiva Bush, the island nation's highest elected official. Then he traveled to London for the Olympics and was introduced by Sands to José Ávila. The two men had never met, and though the Brazilian spoke excellent Spanish, as well as his native Portuguese, his English was quite poor. As a result, they spoke for only a few minutes, little more than a handshake, and a few smiled formalities. But Webb dispatched Sands right afterward to convey an important message to his former boss. Webb wanted Traffic to become the official company of CONCACAF, Sands told Ávila, sitting in the lobby bar of the Mayfair Hotel. Webb would agree to sell all of the Confederation's television and sponsorship rights exclusively to the firm. But, Sands added, Webb also demanded bribes worth 25% above every deal, a figure that left Avila's jaw on the floor. After more than two decades of negotiating payoffs to soccer officials, Ávila had thought he had seen everything. Leoz, the South American Confederation president, had once taken a rights contract, unsigned, into his hotel room and refused to endorse it until Ávila promised him $1 million on the spot. Heads of national associations routinely demanded free uniforms, balls, and other equipment on top of money, not to mention free airfare, accommodations, and VIP tickets to events. Some officials wouldn't even send their national team's best players to compete in tournaments if they didn't get a little extra money on the side first. These men weren't blind. They saw how profitable Traffic was, and how wealthy buying up soccer rights had made Ávila. If there was so much money to be made from the game, the officials figured, they wanted their piece. But Webb's expectations were truly astronomical. He'd already extracted $3 million to sign the piddling CFU World Cup qualifiers contract, which amounted to almost 15% of the face value of the accord. That deal had been in conjunction with Media World, as part of Traffic's arrangement to split CONCACAF qualifier contracts between the two firms. As a result, Avila's own share of the bribe was only $1.5 million. But then again, $1.5 million was still quite a lot of money. At first, Ávila flatly dismissed the notion of agreeing to pay even larger bribes to Webb. Considering how rapidly the value of rights contracts had been escalating, he could soon be on the hook for tens of millions of dollars if he didn't push back. "You shouldn't get involved in this kind of thing," Ávila told Sands in London. "You're just starting your career." "It's not me," Sands protested. "It's Jeff." "You're just an intermediary, Enrique," Ávila replied. "This isn't going to happen." But Sands kept insisting as the weeks and months went by, saying Traffic had to keep Webb happy if it wanted to lock down the region and keep out competitors like Full Play. "Besides," he pleaded, "it would help him prove to Webb that he, as General Secretary, could deliver." Ávila had known Sands for a dozen years, had attended his wedding and felt protective of him. On the one hand, it troubled him that his protege was getting so deeply involved in the filthiest side of the business, the part that he personally hated the most. But on the other hand, Ávila desperately wanted Sands to succeed, for both of their sakes. On November 13th, Traffic wired $1 million of the bribe it owed Webb for the CFU qualifiers. It used the complicated series of transfers Sands and Ávila had settled upon months earlier, and included a $200,000 fee to pay the middlemen who helped obscure the payment. 2 weeks later, CONCACAF officially announced its latest rights agreement, ceding exclusively to Traffic the sponsorship, marketing, advertising, and hospitality rights for the 2013 Gold Cup, the next two editions of the CONCACAF Champions League, and several smaller tournaments. Ávila hadn't been terribly excited about the new deal. It was true that it brought the Confederation's premier tournament back to Traffic for the first time in more than a decade. But the 2013 Gold Cup was scarcely 6 months away, leaving no time to properly market the event or line up new sponsors. In the end, all Traffic was able to do was renew Miller Lite as the exclusive beer of the tournament. Seen in that